Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV, and we bring you this podcast a couple of times a month to catch you up on what is going on in those worlds. I'm going to talk today with Dan Friedman, the current editor in chief of Book and Film Globe, or as I like to call him, the Dandalorian, and we're going to talk about The Mandalorian and Grogu, the annoying new Star Wars movie that is failing in theaters right now and introduces you to the terrible new character of Rada the Hutt, the wayward son of Jabba the Hutt, a character that we didn't need and we didn't want, but we got, and Dan and I are going to pick that apart a little bit later. I'm also going to talk to Stephen Garrett, our chief film critic, who is just back from the Cannes Film Festival, and he's going to provide a roundup of what went on there. But first, I'm going to talk to Daniel Aaron, a Book and Film Globe contributor, who's been writing about movies for us lately, and he wrote a movie review of a movie called Obsession, which is a movie that I'm kind of obsessed with these days, and I'm going to talk to Daniel Aaron about Obsession right after this trailer from Obsession.
Have you ever actually, like, flirted with Nikki?
I'm gonna go get some shots.
I'll come with you
if she means this much to you.
And I know she does.
Say, Nikki, I think we should grab a drink sometime.
Nikki, wait, I was gonna ask you,
What?
I lost my train of thought.
Good night.
What else?
Why?
One wish, Willow. You only get one wish. I wish Nikki Freeman loved me more than anyone in the entire world.
I love you so much. Only the branch of a willow tree could conjure.
It's weird how you two are dating all of a sudden. Like, super dating.
I think Nikki is going through something.
Like what? Is she okay?
No.
Jeez, what kind of spell did you put on her?
A genre of movie that we've talked about a lot on this program is the burgeoning, or at this point established genre of like horror comedy. I guess you'd call it elevated horror comedy. We're not talking about Scary Movie, although there is a new Scary Movie coming out this year. To me, those are some of the best and most innovative films that Hollywood is making now. Movies like Companion and Weapons and Bodies. And there's a whole raft of them. Barbarian is another one. And there's another one in theaters now that's a big hit and I feel like fits really, really well into the genre. It's called Obsession. And I saw it. I mean, obviously we're talking about it, so I saw it. But Daniel Aaron, who is a contributor from he writes for Rock and Roll Globe, our sister site, and has begun writing for Book and Film Globe under Dan Freeman's tenure. And Daniel is here today to talk to me about Obsession.
Hello. Hi, how's it going, Neil?
It's going well. I broke my one wish, Willow, and I was like, I wish I could talk to Daniel about Obsession. I didn't. There's no monkey's paw because, unless you start showing up at my house and always want to talk about Obsession.
Well, I was planning to. So,
yeah. Well, why do you say that? You should be like, why? Why would you say that? And then you have to scream at me in a really creepy way. All right. So obviously we're riffing on a movie that you may not have seen or heard about, but it's a monkey's paw premise, basically. Like, and in fact, the 26-year-old director Curry Barker, who I guess he was born when I was 30, you know, so you know, a young fellow. Said he made this movie because he was inspired not by the original Monkey's Paw short story, but by the Simpsons Monkey's Paw episode.
Which was probably my first introduction to the trope, too. So, yeah. Very generational.
It's generational. It also is like just, you know, one of the best uses of it ever. Yeah. But you know, the thing about Obsession is that, yes, it's a Monkey's Paw story. And it is a... And that, you know, the ironic twist that you wish for something and it goes horribly awry has been used over and over again. But I feel like that's not really what this movie is about, which is why I think it's quite effective.
Yeah, it's I mean, I tend to love things where it's, you know, a pretty simple premise, or you take, like, you know, a not terribly different version of a trope and you just do a really excellent version of it, you know. And with horror, there's kind of always room to do, I don't know, better acting or funnier dialogue and such. Like, even like classic horror movies, like, you know, they kind of left a lot of room to just kind of always do new, I don't know. That's why I guess there's always reboots of things. You can always do like a funnier Halloween or something, you know,
or a scarier or a
warrior. Right, exactly. Grittier, you know, reboots. Yeah.
But okay. So this is the Monkey's Paw story. But what I thought was interesting about it is it's kind of like a mumblecore Gen Z romance movie. You know, our main character, his name is Bear or Baron, and he is a young man. In the movie, I couldn't quite tell how old they all were. They're like just out of high school, or like they're in their early 20s. And he is not someone who is very in touch with his feelings and able to express himself. You know, and I'm the parent of a 23-year-old, and I know him and his friends, and it's true. Like this generation is not, you know, this is not the these are not Gen Xers who are just constantly expressing what they think directly, or they're not these millennials who have all the feels. They are really reluctant to commit to anything.
Feels are cringe is what I hear. So.
Yeah. And but, you know, Bear is in love with this woman. What's the character?
Nikki.
I know the actress is Nikki. Yes. The actress's name is Indy Navarette. Yes. She is astonishingly good in this film. But you know, Nikki is like I don't know exactly how to describe her, like a party girl, basically, like with some perhaps an edge, mm-hmm. A little indie dark side thing going on. You know, the kind of girl like people have crushes on, woman who people have crushes on in their 20s. Mm-hmm. But he can't ever admit to Nikki that he's in love with her. So he finds this object called the One Wish Willow, which is this creepy monkey's paw type thing that he buys at like a new age store, and he breaks it in half and wishes quickly that she loves him more than anyone else in the whole world. And that really, that's basically the premise of the movie. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've had a lot of discussions about this movie since watching it. It's interesting because I've seen some takes where it's like the wish that he makes, you know, that the One Wish Willow isn't evil, that he just, you know, he just wished for something in a very stupid way. Which, you know, with the monkey's paw, it's kind of, well, with the trope, it's kind of like, you know, no matter what you say or how you say it, you're going to, you know, there's always going to be like a other shoe going to drop or something. With this, I don't know if I agree with that necessarily, because what does he say? I believe the words he uses, he says, "I wish she loved me more than anything in the world." And the stuff that she ends up doing.
In the
fucking world, yes. And the stuff that she ends up doing, you know, it's not indicative of love, really. You know, I mean, there's stuff like if he said, "I wish she wanted me that more than anything in the world," or "I wish she wanted to be with me more than anything in the world," then I could sort of see maybe he brought it on himself a little bit. But I think that the One Wish Willow's conception of love is pretty toxic. So, yeah.
There's a scene late in the movie where he goes back to the store to try to find another One Wish Willow. And the owner of the store is like, he's like, "Can you just do a wish for me to reverse my wish?" And the owner's like, "No, I already did my wish. I'm fine." Right. And he seemed fine. So it's obvious that, you know, if he had just said something like, "I wish Nikki would love me for who I am, and that we would have a normal, healthy relationship that lasts for the rest of our lives and doesn't end up in any kind of bloody mess," that probably would have worked.
Right. I mean, it's kind of hard to say, though, because, you know, like, the definition of love doesn't usually include...
Sure, there's always this thing like, well, what level of irony do you want the monkey's paw to bestow upon you?
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's some stuff that Nikki does that's, like, pretty obviously outside of the realm of any kind of, you know, loophole of love, really. So it's, you know, I personally would argue that that the toy is definitely evil. There's a scene where he's on, you know, the phone with customer service from the you know, demonic One Wish Willow company or whatever, and there's simply stuff that he hears on that call that make it pretty obvious that they're sort of, you know, enjoying his ruin with everything, So
it's a demonic possession story. All right. So let's talk really to me, though. I mean, yeah. So this movie could be good or it could be bad, but really it rides and dies on the performance of Indy Navarrete.
Yeah.
And she is, I mean, she does things in this movie that, like, I have not seen a performer do. There's that scene at the party where she reads that weird short story that she's working on.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so well, I mean, so good. She's so good.
I believe that I read that it was the Curry Barker's father who penned the creepy short story thing for the scene.
Is that Clive Barker?
Is it Clive Barker?
I mean, that would, I don't know. I don't, that would make think sense. It is,
but that would make sense. yeah, it was like, I mean, it's also just crazy to think about someone's parent kind of handing that to you. It's like if I remember right, it's sort of like an incestuous erotic story. So it's just, you know, it's a very, yeah, like there's nothing like that in most horror movies or anything. It really goes beyond. Yeah.
And it's a long speed, and it's a couple of minutes, and it really lingers on her, and she's not doing anything other than reading, like, a really, you cut to some of the people at the party who are like, what is this about? You know, because a lot of the other stuff she's doing is, like, involves, like, you know, bodily fluids or voice acting or, like, you know, weird emotional shifts. But to me, that scene is, like, it really shows, like, this is an actor. Oh, like, this is someone who's here to stay.
Absolutely. I mean, she gets quite a few little showcases in the movie, and you also kind of pointed out something else that I love about the movie is that there's some scenes where you can see a character sees something horrific, and you're kind of watching their face, and they're sort of reacting to it, but the viewer can't see what it is, and you know, eventually the camera kind of, you know, turns so that we can see what they're seeing, but you just sort of see the, like, elevation of horror or unsettling, you know, whatever's going on in their face without knowing why just yet. And the movie's really effective with that.
Yeah. And, you know, but again, it's really kind of a one character movie, because I felt the guy who plays Bear, who has a lot of screen time, he was okay, you know, I found him sort of annoying after a while, which perhaps is the point. But there are two other characters that play his friends, and they're in it a lot. And I don't think they're no better or worse than your average actor in a Friday the 13th movie.
I don't know about that. I think that it might not be the acting, but they might just be written to be a little more nuanced as characters. And I do think that the movie gets good mileage out of the fact that no one is really like a stock character in this. Like, everyone's like, even Bear, who's pretty annoying and kind of, you know, kind of insufferable and just really, I don't know, is whiny the word? Just kind of meek. Yeah. Yes. And, you know, he's, you know, it's not like a special performance or anything, but yeah, obviously you need someone like that who kind of doesn't take up as much, doesn't chew as much of the scenery as Nikki does on screen to complement it. But I was thinking, though, like the friend Sarah, who...
Yeah, she was good.
Well, just mostly the fact that, you know, there's sort of different... I'm trying to think of how to not spoil this. There's different romantic kind of dynamics going on within this friend group, and she's not really predatory. She's not really, no one's really outwardly like a certain way, you know?
I like Sarah as a character. Right. She's kind of like a punk rock girl next door.
Yeah. So I think that it's more effective when something terrible happens to someone very suddenly in the movie, you know, that, you know, it's not really someone where, you know, you're waiting for them to get it. I mean, maybe the Ian character a little bit, but for the and maybe Bear to some extent, but for the most part, you know, you're not really like, man, I can't wait for this horrible, you know, for this comeuppance or whatever. But even though you also kind of are, but it's just not the way that I don't know, like Final Destination stacks the deck with you know, just types.
No.
Yeah. So yeah.
No. And Andy Richter, very underused. Yes. In this film. I feel like that character got left on the cutting room floor. I'm like, I mean, I know that Andy Richter, it's not like having you know, a huge name in your cast.
Right.
He was there. He was there. I saw him a couple of times, I think.
Yeah, I'd kind of love to know, you know, was he just around, like, were they just like, hey, we should, you know, get you for this or something? But yeah, it does feel a little bit like a missed opportunity.
Maybe he was just walking past, right, down the street in Sherman Oaks, mm-hmm, or whatever, where they were filming, and they pulled him in. All right, well, listen, we got to cut this short, but I think both Dan and I would give Obsession very high marks. Definitely one of the best movies I've seen this,
absolutely,
year. You know, and it just shows that, like, when it comes to this sort of low budget horror comedy, there's no better place for Hollywood to try out new directors than with this genre.
Absolutely.
All right, Dan, thank you so much. I wish that this conversation could go on forever, but it's not going to.
Talk to you thank later. You so much, Neil.
Stephen Garrett is back from his annual trip to the Cannes Film Festival. Bonsoir, Stephen.
Bonsoir, ça va?
Où est le cinéma?
Où est le cinéma? Le cinéma, c'est toujours.
Toujours. All right, so back from Cannes. You wrote about it extensively on Book and Film Globe. And it sounds like the usual mishmash of good stuff and pretentious nonsense.
Yeah, it was a nice mix. They sometimes will refer to years as vintage years, you know, like, you know, the year that Parasite and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood both played, mm-hmm, was a pretty good year. There was no big thunderclap movie this year, but there was solid stuff, very respectable entries from very respected directors. And, you know, I can't say it was a total waste of time. No, it was good. It was a solid can. A lot of people were hand-wringing because, you know, no Hollywood movies were there and there were no big celebrities. It's not like Tom Cruise was there with Top Gun Maverick like he did a few years ago or even last year with Mission Possible. You know, there's nothing, no big popcorn movies.
Why were there no Hollywood movies this year?
Well, that is a good question. There have been for years these thought pieces talking about how Hollywood is averse to going to Cannes because it costs millions of dollars and they can be just absolutely slayed by the critics, who, you know, are very unkind, very happily unkind in Europe, especially Cannes, if there's a movie that is not at least striving for artistic, you know, kind of greatness. Now, that said, Ocean's 13 played there, Shrek played there, you know, even Solo, a Han, you know, a Star Wars story played there. So it's not like there isn't, like, the Da Vinci Code opened 1 year. But of course, that was 20 years ago. And I think maybe Hollywood's a little skittish about, you know, blowing their chances at the, you know, the global box office if they don't have something they really believe in. And also the big movies like Disclosure Day and The Odyssey, you know, they're always salivating for that kind of thing. And Spielberg has definitely brought movies, certainly more recently, you know, like the BFG and things like that. So he could have brought that.
It seems to me like Disclosure Day and The Odyssey would have been perfect fits for this festival.
Well, like, yes and no. I mean, Disclosure Day, I think, is really riding on a lot of the element of surprise. So I think they want people to find out about that movie when it opens, and they don't want to spoil anything if it plays in Cannes a month before it opens. And, you know, everybody talks about Christopher Nolan and you know, how he should play Cannes, and why doesn't he play Cannes, and will he play Cannes this year? He's never played Cannes. He's never had any movie in a festival other than Memento at Toronto, and I think at Sundance. He's a high concept guy that always opens wide in July with all of his movies, like, always. You know, so like
I always open wide in July as well.
It's open wide in July. I say that about you all the time.
That's when I go to the dentist. So
yeah, exactly. So, you know, hey, sometimes they can't always have big stars. You know, I think Paper Tiger, which is this James Gray movie, which is, you know, a very studied, very earnest, and you know, kind of genre inflected, kind of auto fiction. About a family in Queens kind of getting into a tussle with the Russian mob. And that was kind of starry. It had Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson and Miles Teller. But Scarlett was not there. ScarJo had a scheduling conflict. And actually, from the premiere, James Gray tried to FaceTime her, and she did not pick up, which made people giggle a little bit.
So wait a second. So our big... Our big prestige movie was a James Gray autofiction.
Exactly.
Okay.
I mean, pretty much in terms of English language, yeah. I mean, yeah. It really, like, there was that. There was, you know. Look, actually, the big breakout movie of the festival was this movie Club Kid, which Jordan Firstman did. Jordan Firstman's a writer, comedian, kind of an out there gay comic who is kind of Instagram famous, but then actually became famous because he's hilarious and smart and funny. And this is his writing directing debut, which he also stars in. And it's basically, it's almost like people were calling it Big Daddy meets Kramer versus Kramer. You know, it's like, it's a long in the tooth 40 something club kid, you know, ironically kid, of course he's not, gets a visit from a woman who drops off his unbeknownst to him 10-year-old son who he had in like a drug fueled like kind of menage a trois 10 years earlier and had no recollection of it. He's like, I'm gay, like how did I have, and somebody was like, no honey, you had sex with a woman. He's like, I did. Anyway, so it's about him learning to grow up because he has to take care of this young boy who's absolutely adorable, and the whole thing is very touching, very hilarious. It's not a fresh idea, but it's done in a fresh way that I think sounds good.
I would see that.
It's, you know what? And A24 agrees, and they spent $17 million picking it up. And there was another deal for a really ambitious, really interesting, also another gay film called The Black Black Ball, which kind of begs for jokes. Anyway, there was a film called Sheep in the Box, and we had just kept singing the title, you know, a la Dick in the Box. But anyway, The Black Ball, which is a really like big, sprawling, kind of ambitious Spanish film by two guys named Javier, who go by Los Javis. And Pedro Almodovar kind of co-produced it, and it has cameos from Penelope Cruz and Glenn Close. And it's this very sprawling movie. It actually won Best Director when it came to awards time. That got picked up by Netflix. It's a sprawling movie that goes all the way back to the Spanish Civil War and goes all the way up to 2017 and involves a lost play or a long forgotten play and considered never to be found, but is discovered. And it's a play by Garcia Lorca, which speaks overtly of homosexuality, which, you know, he was gay but never actually spoke about it in his plays. So very ambitious, really fun, beautifully directed, wild time. And that Netflix picked up for U.S. Distribution for about $5 million. So you'll probably hearing a lot about that movie as well as Club Kid. And also you'll be hearing about Fjord, which won the Palme d'Or, the top prize of the festival. That is a movie directed by a Romanian director named Christian Mungiu, who actually has won the Palme d'Or before, almost 20 years ago, for an abortion drama called 4 Months, 3 Weeks, and 2 Days.
I know that movie. That's an excellent film. Yeah, it's an excellent film.
Fjord,
please tell me it's about an iceberg hitting the coast of Romania.
A metaphorical iceberg.
Oh.
It is about a Romanian family. So it stars Sebastian Stan, who is, of course, the Winter Soldier from the Marvel movies, right? But is also was born in Romania. He is Romanian-American. And he speaks English and Romanian in this film. He looks like a dork. He plays an IT guy. He's balding. He has very short, you know, cropped hair. He's wearing glasses. And he's married to a woman played by Renata Reinsva, who is Norwegian in the film. And so this family, and they're religious fundamentalists, and they have 5 kids. And they move from Romania to Norway to be closer to her family. And then they get accused of child abuse because one of the kids, one of the teenage kids, shows up at school with bruises that she refuses to explain. And so the child services immediately assumes that there's child abuse from this, you know, these religious fundamentalists who are kind of rubbing the very progressive Norwegian community the wrong way because they're playing songs like Amazing Grace on the school piano, or they're talking about reading Bible passages and things like nothing too crazy. They just seem very conservative.
And when you rub people the wrong way, you get bruises.
You get bruises, metaphorical bruises. So, but this is the interesting thing. Okay, so you mentioned 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, which is an abortion drama. So you think the politics are, of course, more liberal leaning. This is a movie that really kind of tweaks the libs, you know? And some people were kind of muttering under their breath, oh, this is such a MAGA movie, because it presents religious a conservative religious family in a sympathetic light as they fight against a very overreaching progressive state, nanny state, that feels like it knows how to raise their children better than they do, you know? So it'll be a very interesting movie to see play out, because basically what this Romanian director is saying, the way he did in 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days, is we're living in an authoritarian regime that is not allowing us personal liberties and freedom, you know? And
that autonomy. That is a very provocative point of view. I don't think a MAGA-coded movie is possible from Romania, given the actual meaning of MAGA, but I think it's interesting that artists are, you know, it takes a lot of guts to criticize sort of liberal authoritarianism. It's really easy artistically to criticize conservative authoritarianism. Every that you get that, you know, in your average sitcom episode will do that, but to criticize sort of the liberal side of things, it sounds good. I mean, I would definitely see, even if there's not an actual fjord in it, I would like to see a fjord.
You can see one in the background. In the background, there is a
fjord. Okay, that's good. You can see that. Okay,
yeah,
that's good.
You get your fjord in this.
It's an implied fjord. All right, well, Stephen, I'm going to let you go here because there's a fjord moving down my street. We have to evacuate. I suppose maybe next year I'll go to Ken with you. You can just kind of put me in your carry-on.
Yeah, absolutely. You should.
I'll pop out of the bag like Curious George and be like, oh my goodness.
I think you'd get a kick out of it. I think you would love it. You've mentioned you want to come. You should totally come.
I would have the time of my life. And someday before I die, I will go. So it would have to
be chaque jour. Chaque jour.
Au revoir, mon ami.
A bientôt. Au revoir.
It's been 7 years since the last big screen Star Wars movie. It seems like a long time, although you remember that between the Return of the Jedi and The Phantom Menace, it was 16 years. So 7 isn't that long. But considering how much Star Wars content they've uploaded to us in the last half century, 7 years is a long time. However, after seeing The Mandalorian and Grogu, I'm hoping for at least another 7 year break. 27 would be fine. If I never see another Star Wars again, I would be perfectly happy. The knowing chuckle in the background, that's Dan Friedman, editor in chief of Book and Film Globe, who also saw The Mandalorian and Grogu and reviewed it for Book and Film Globe. Hello.
Good morning, Dale. I saw it a long time ago. I've had a bit of time to forget about it, but you're gonna throw salt in all those wounds.
Yeah. Well, as we're talking, I'm less than 24 hours, fewer than 24 hours away from my Mandalorian and Grogu screening. Okay, let's talk about what works in the movie first. There's a couple of good actions. There's a lot of action in the movie. Tons of action. I mean, I had a headache. There was so much action. You know, I thought that some of the, you know, set pieces were okay. You know, there's a good bar fight. There were a couple of other action sequences that worked. I thought that sort of two-thirds of the way through where they showed Baby Yoda's, you know, learning his healing powers, that was sort of a nice quiet interlude that was a good character moment. That stuff all worked. But, man.
I mean, Star Wars, as you pointed out, over the last half century, shows that it knows how to do certain bits of storytelling. And, you know, and Jon Favreau, the director of this, has learned that. And the franchise tells him how to do it. And so just like any Chick-fil-A, he can grill or whatever, bread a chicken fillet. Like, but it doesn't mean it's a great film.
No, it's certainly not a great film. I'm just saying that it does have a few moments sort of in the mythology that work. You know, that whole early on, the whole sequence that takes place basically on the set of Blade Runner.
Yeah, exactly. Or Black Rain. It's not clear which.
Or Black Rain, but it's that vibe, which I hadn't seen much of in Star Wars. So that was kind of fun. The real problem, there's a couple of problems with this movie.
One of the real problems. Among the real problems.
the main problem, I think, is it's not structural. Like, it's structured fine. Like, it goes da-da-da-da-da, beat to beat to beat to beat to, you know, all the beats are hit. But the actual writing within the beats is terrible. the actual individual lines that the characters are forced to utter are beyond cliched.
For our listeners who haven't watched this, one of the main heroes is a vast slug, a new generation of Hutt, Jabba's son, Rotta the Hutt, played by Jeremy Allen White. And maybe it's actually just a very long prank on Jeremy Allen White as revenge.
Well, I was going to get to that. The real problem with this movie, it's called The Mandalorian and Grogu. We've seen a lot of The Mandalorian. There's been three seasons of Din Djarin, The Mandalorian. So there's nothing new there. The movie does it in the second half. The first half I was like, where's Grogu? And the second half, it does finally develop the Grogu, the Baby Yoda character, which is the one everyone likes. But the problem with this movie is it's really a stealth origin story for a new character that no one asked for, Rotta the Hutt. There's a lot of Rotta the Hutt in this movie. And, you know, when we see Rotta the Hutt, he's being held prisoner by some, you know, boxing promoter in Blade Runner, even though he's like clearly like incredibly powerful and could have broken out of his cell at any time.
Because he doesn't want to. He's settled for this Faustian bargain, which he is naive enough to believe in.
He lives in a cell and he gets massages and he has washboard abs. He-Man doesn't have abs like Rotta the Hutt.
I mean, for a slug, this is one seriously built being.
He's freaking jacked, Dan. Rotta the Hutt is jacked. But the real problem, that's fine. A jacked Hutt fighting in an arena, whatever.
When you say it that way, it just sounds fine.
This is Star Wars. It's not Ingmar Bergman. Okay, we're not looking for subtlety here. We're not, you know, this isn't like Sentimental Value too. We're not looking for something like subtle. The problem is the way Rotta the Hutt is written and the way Jeremy Allen delivers those lines, he just sounds like a lackadaisical bro. Like, oh man, I don't want to be my father's son. You know what I'm saying? It just sucks to be a Hutt. And it just goes on and on. He pats Grogu on the head. He's like, you're a good kid. I'm like,
I know. And they try to play this whole like baby, brilliant, wise thing, which is Yoda, and then or Grogu, I guess, and then next to this somewhat adult but young adult massive slug, and it's like a twins moment. It's not even as good as Twins, which is not even as good as a real comedy.
As most things, it doesn't work, and it's just the character is so weird and flat and uninspiring. And then just when you think you're rid of him, they bring him back in the third act for lots more fun with Rotta the Hutt. I mean. You know, and the thing is, like, he talks like a surf bro, right? Whatever. But the rest of the Hutts in the movie, and there are other Hutts, they still talk like Jabba the Hutt. They're like, bleh, 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 solo, you know, which is how Hutts are supposed to talk. They're like space slug gangsters. But then this guy comes in, and it's like he just got dropped out of Encino Man.
It's true. I do wonder whether Jeremy Allen White is just phoning it in, or whether it's just this elaborate prank on him that he has to do this.
It's insanity, maybe as
penance for his Bruce Springsteen impression or something.
Well, it's clear that America's crush on Jeremy Allen White from The Bear has quickly turned clownish with his Bruce Springsteen performance, and then this thing. You know, the thing about Rotta the Hutt, Star Wars does this, right? You think it's going okay. And then it'll swerve in these directions that where you're just like, what? Like, you know, with Jar Jar Binks. Like, we didn't need Jar Jar Binks.
Right.
And then suddenly we had him, and then we had his whole mythology, and we couldn't escape him. We didn't need Rotta the Hutt. In fact, I'm hearing that they're going to make a Rotta the Hutt solo movie.
No.
They're going to do it.
No.
And who's going to see that?
Oh, no. I might take people I don't like to see it.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, it truly is like, this is like, an incredible the thing about Jar Jar Binks is he showed up at a time of maximum enthusiasm for Star Wars. I would say the enthusiasm for Star Wars with the arrival and basically flop of The Mandalorian and Grogu is at an all-time low. Star Wars is at its lowest possible ebb, and they're trying to rescue it with this character. It's like it's Itchy and Scratchy's new pal Poochie.
I think you're right about it being a low ebb for the movies, but I think and what was really disappointing about it with this was that I think that The Mandalorian itself, the initial season,
the first season, but that was years ago.
Yeah. But then Andor more recently, I think, has yes. shown hope for it. I didn't particularly like Ahsoka, but certain people, you know, it had certain things. I think it was basically flawed, but it was interesting. And I think these series have things to show, but the Mandalorian and Grogu had none of it. And Rot of the Hutt, I hadn't heard that they were going to use him to
his fullest extent. That said, I didn't mind the battle scene with Rod of the Hutt and the Mandalorian against all those wacky monsters.
As you said, the set pieces, it knows what to do. Like, you go to a Star Wars movie, like, you expect there to be a chase sequence. You expect there to be, like, monsters, weird-ass monsters fighting each other. You expect the good guys to win against all the odds. And, you know, and that's fine. I have no issue with that. That happened. It happened in a good way. And the monsters... And there was also kind of an interesting subtext, you know, that the monsters that you create are the ones you have to worry about, you know, and so both in
I think that's giving the script way too much credit, but sure.
Because it happened a couple of times, and then also, you know, that I think that Rotter himself is the monster, the reverse monster that Jabba creates and escapes. So.
I don't know. I don't like the idea of like a Hutt being like the hero of a Star Wars movie. It just makes no sense. It's not fun. He's not fun to watch, you know, and every time he opens his mouth, you're just like, please let this scene in.
I'm with you on that. There's very little. But the other thing is with Mandalorian and Grogu is that, and I pointed this out in the review, that the Mandalorian basically doesn't speak. He's sort of Clint Eastwood, you know, on steroids, and Grogu can't speak. So, like, how do you hang a full feature movie off to
on characters who don't talk? On characters who don't talk, you have to give them Rod of the Hutt, who never freaking shuts up.
You have to have a logorrheic bro in the body of a jacked up slug.
Yeah, that's the solution. That's the screenwriting solution for that Jon Favreau came up with. Okay, well, now I'm sure you're all are dying to go see The Mandalorian Grogu after this review from Dan Friedman and I. But Dan, thank you for forcing. Yes, you didn't force me to go see this, but
thank you for making me revisit my trauma.
Yeah, that's what going to the movies is all about. Dan, I'll talk to you soon.
Speak to you soon. Bye.
All right. Thank you, Dan Friedman. This is the way. The Mandalorian and Grogu will be on Disney Plus probably before I'm done with this sentence. It's not doing great in the theaters for a Star Wars movie, and there's no reason to run to see it. If you're a completist, and if you like train wreck characters, it's definitely the movie for you. Thank you also to Stephen Garrett, who went to Cannes. The sacrifice he shows for this job is amazing, and he brought back a report from France, from the south of France, where he hangs out on the Lido or whatever they call it and sees films every year. And thanks to Daniel Aaron for talking to me about Obsession, which is a terrific horror comedy in the theaters now that you should all check out. I'm Neil Pollack. I am the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We are a product of Sea of Reeds Media, and I will talk to you soon.
Audio Hoppa.